This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. President Obama faces many crises as he moves into the White House. Poverty may be one of them. We speak with Christian activist Jim Wallace.
We could have 9-10 million new Americans in poverty. This would move us from 36 million to 45 million in a very short time, and that would be a real poverty emergency.
Plus, radio drama in the tribal region of Pakistan. And selling water from a sheepskin sack on the streets of Morocco.
There are people who buy bottled water, but the water from the garab sack, there's something special in it. It's not the same as tap water or as bottled water. There's goodness in the water.
First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. President Barack Obama is hard at work in the White House. Many are watching to see whether he can keep his campaign promises while we're in the middle of the worst financial crisis since the Depression. One of those promises was to cut domestic poverty in half within the next 10 years. But is that really possible in this economic climate? Jim Wallace has some thoughts on that. He's been an advisor to Barack Obama's transition team on the issue of domestic poverty. Wallace is a liberal evangelical activist who's well known for his leadership in this arena. He's the founder of Sojourners, a Christian social justice organization based in Washington, D.C. We spoke with Jim Wallace the day after the inauguration.
During the campaign, we had a CNN forum that Sojourners co-sponsored with CNN. And I asked him, you know, would he be willing to commit to cut poverty in half in this country in 10 years? And he made that commitment in front of millions of people. And I know he believes it. So that was a great start. We had a meeting just last week, a lot of heads at churches and with Melody Barnes, his domestic policy council advisor. And she was very responsive, and she said poverty's going to be on their agenda. This is the beginning of a conversation. It's a continuing conversation and not the same conversation over and over again, she said. But I want to say big things like this don't happen until there are social movements pushing and pressing from the outside. So our job now is to pray and support, but also to challenge and push and make sure that the poorest are not left off the agenda here.
Since President Obama made that commitment to cut poverty in half, things have really changed. The economy has bottomed out. He has all kinds of interest groups pressing him to keep his campaign promises, this being one of them. You've been regularly in touch with his team. Do you think he's still planning to keep this promise?
Well, Peggy, we have a situation here we haven't seen for some time. The people in town whose numbers I trust on poverty tell me that they expect 9 or 10 million more Americans to be pushed into poverty. This is amazing, 36 million to 45 in the next year or months. I think this is going to test us all. But I do feel, as I talk to the Obama team, that this is something that is very much on their agenda. But so many other pressures, so many demands, so many obstacles stand in the way. So, you know, I think, you know, really a challenge sometimes is the deepest form of support that we can offer a political leader. So I think he wants to do this. I think he's got people on his team who are committed to it. But we're going to have to push and push hard to make sure that both at home here and around the world, that those whom Jesus calls the least of these are not forgotten.
Has he given you any really tangible, close-to-the-ground solutions that he's planning to implement?
Well, the first thing is the stimulus package itself has to be targeted very directly for poor people. And so we talked about that to his team. So in other words, things that, you know, that really help people who are struggling to get by are going to be part of this. So I think we have to make sure the stimulus itself is not just focused on the middle class, but focused on the poor. So family tax credits, unemployment insurance has to be strengthened, health care, education. It seems like the stimulus will have a lot of focus on education, and that's critical for investing in the future. A lot of young people who otherwise couldn't go to college, I think, need to find the help that they need to go. In fact, I think, you know, the whole green economy, clean energy economy, you know, jobs future really is a very hopeful thing for a lot of inner city youth. These are good jobs. We can train young kids to do these jobs. And I think that's a big part of this. I think education, healthcare, jobs, tax credit, low-income tax credits. These are the things that I think can make a difference right now in the stimulus package.
And are these the things that you're pushing, or are these the things he's promising he's going to do?
Well, we're pushing, others are pushing, and it looks like in the initial drafts of the package, some of this looks like it's going to be there. So I think there are some hopeful signs in the recovery package for low-income people. We're not there yet, hasn't been passed yet, and you know the temptation of Congress sometimes is to get rid of that stuff that is just focused on poor people. So we got to fight for that stuff in this package. The main thing, though, I think the country has to hear a clear word from people of faith and other people of conscience that you know, we can't leave the old poor behind, if you use that language. There's new poor now. There are people losing their homes, foreclosures, and people losing jobs. But a lot of folks are already in crisis. They've been in crisis a long time, and they're going to even be in greater jeopardy now. So I think, you know, all of us are now in this together. And so we've got to start talking about the common good. The common good has got to replace individual gain and individual interests and selfish interests. And we have to all of us figure out how we're going to get through this together. You know, I learned, Peggy, the peak of giving in our history was in 1933. People gave more to the churches and to the poor at the height of the Depression. Now,
why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's counterintuitive, isn't it? It's not what you'd think. It may mean that crisis can bring out the best in us. If we just respond by hoarding and fear and self-protection, we'll miss the opportunity. The crisis is a time for us to change our habits, our attitudes, looking after my own interests first or just mine. That can change too. And so it could be a new time of saying the common good is really for our own good. And maybe generosity could be a consequence of a crisis. And wouldn't that be a powerful thing?
And you're talking about public individual generosity, not the government's generosity?
Well, both. I mean, you know, I've had people who have been on Obama's economic, transition team say to me things like, what if we have 10 million more people in poverty? We're going to have a mobilization by the faith community, by the unions, by student organizations, civic groups. We're going to have to all pull together if there really is a poverty emergency in this country.
Are you prepared for that? Are you prepared for a poverty emergency? And what would you tell the major churches and religious groups in this country to do?
Well, here's the thing. As you know, if there is such an emergency, people will look to the faith community and nonprofit organizations. And the challenge is many of those organizations themselves are in economic crisis right now, cutting back staff and program. So this is going to be the challenge here. But the presidents who have been the best presidents have been those who served in times of crisis. And I think this kind of crisis can pull out our worst stuff or our best stuff. And I think Barack Obama is calling for our best stuff, you might say. But we have to also call for the best stuff in him. And we have to create the kind of citizens' movement that really, you know, invites him and holds him accountable to doing the right thing.
All right. Jim Wallace, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here.
That was Jim Wallace, CEO of Sojourners, a Christian social justice organization. He's also a leader of Christian Churches Together, a coalition fighting poverty. On his first full day in office, President Obama called leaders of Egypt, Israel, Jordan, and the West Bank. Some take this as a sign that the new American president will put the Middle East near the top of his agenda. Meanwhile, Palestinians emerged from 3 weeks of bombing to a devastated Gaza. The UN estimates it will cost billions to rebuild the area. There's limited electricity, water, and medical supplies. Last week during the bombing, we spoke with Dr. Musa El-Haddad. We managed to get in touch with him after the Israeli withdrawal to hear how he was faring. Thank you so much for joining us again.
No problem.
Since the ceasefire, you've been able to get out of your apartment and not just back and forth to the hospital, but out in the neighborhood. What are you seeing now?
Well, I'm seeing massive destruction of everything you can imagine. Animals, mostly houses, apartments, and apartment buildings, blown up doors or big holes in the walls from missiles, from the tanks or from the gunboats. It's unbelievable, unbelievable.
Much worse than you anticipated, even though you were up late at night hearing the shelling every night?
Oh, yes, oh, yes. During the shellings, we were hearing explosions, but now they are pulling. Yesterday, they pulled out 100 bodies from under the rubble of those destroyed houses. They've been dead for days. You know, it's horrible the way they look. Children, you know, children and women, you can't believe the way they look. Today, Ban Ki-moon was here and he visited the United Nations centers and schools that were bombarded, and he was shocked.
What are your friends and neighbors saying? I'm sure you've caught up with a lot of people that you were worried about before. Have you been able to find your friends?
Yeah, I have so many friends and family members, actually, my cousins and that. And, you know, I keep hearing stories. Almost everybody I know has either lost his house, lost one or two of his children, or his apartment is on fire. You can write books about the stories that you hear. And I'm sure we are still in the beginning. Every day we'll be hearing worse and worse things.
Yes, you must be greatly relieved that there's a ceasefire.
Yes, we are. But believe me, a ceasefire alone is not okay. Now it's quiet. But as I talk to you, those flights are still roaming up in the air. We can hear them. They are not firing any missiles, but they are in the air, and, you know, there is no guarantee.
As you know, we've just inaugurated a new president in the United States.
Yeah.
Were the Palestinians in Gaza listening to Obama's speech at the inauguration?
Oh, yes. A lot of my friends were. I was, for sure. Either on the radio or on, if you have a generator, then you can watch it on TV because we have no electricity, as you know.
Any thoughts about what that will mean for the future of Gaza?
Well, I know Mr. Obama in his campaign was always talking about change, and I hope he will change the foreign policy of the United States towards the Middle East. So, yes, I'm hopeful that he will be at least fair to the situation here between Israel and Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. All right. Dr. Musa Al-Haddad, thank you so much for joining us again. I know it's late there tonight. I hope you get a good night's rest.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Musa Al-Haddad from Gaza City. And coming up, we tune into a radio show in Pakistan. Stay with us on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. In the tribal region of western Pakistan, radio is still the primary form of communication. It's also the favorite method of extremists for getting out propaganda. But one group of students there is using radio to spread a different kind of propaganda, a message of social change. Will Everett has this report from Peshawar.
Peter Piper picked a pack of pickled peppers.
A dozen students stand in a semicircle doing vocal warm-up exercises. They're actors learning how to articulate their words for radio.
How many pickled peppers did Peter Piper pick?
Other students cluster around computer screens here in a classroom of Peshawar University. They're making last-minute changes to scripts that will soon be broadcast live across the tribal areas of northern Pakistan. One of the writers is Sarah Wazir, a 22-year-old graduate student in communications.
The scene is totally changed. Azam said, "May I go with you then?" No.
She wears a bright blue and yellow sari and usually covers her head as local custom dictates, but not so in this classroom where she flings it off. Sarah is one of 17 students participating in Young Tribal Voices, a radio project funded by the U.S. State Department. She chose to write about a girl from a small village who wants to go to school. It's a sensitive subject in this region where some interpretations of Islam forbid women from getting an education.
One of my cousins went through these all steps which I mentioned in my story. When she came to the city and when she heard and saw the girls going to school, she was shocked. Even she don't have an idea that school is a sort of a place where women can go and get the education. So it is a real story. It happens in my family.
American Hal Ryder is the director of the project. He heads an organization called Ears, Inc. It's done similar dramatic productions for the State Department all over the world. The goal is to empower young people to speak out on social issues. And as for the criticism that an American-run program must be a propaganda tool.
We asked them what they wanted to write about, and they came up with a list of about 16 or 17 themes that they were interested in sharing out in the tribal areas. We've taught the students how to write better, how to stay focused on the issue they brought up, but we haven't edited the material per se.
The three plays commissioned this term deal with drug abuse, religious tolerance, and Sarah's play, which deals with women's rights. Ryder says the play has already stirred up the most debate in the classroom.
There was a big, it was the most animated discussion we'd had in class to date. Sarah was so articulate about her point of view.
The plays are first written and rehearsed in English, so Ryder and his colleagues can help the students tweak the scripts.
My daughter hasn't talked with me for a whole week.
Why is that?
Because I would let her to go school.
In this scene, a father consults a cleric for advice after an argument with his daughter.
How can I help?
I need to know what the Quran tells us in this situation, so I may do the right thing.
2 weeks later, in a university auditorium, the students perform for an audience of around 200. As the play begins, some of the students operate a sound effects table simulating household noises. The rest wait their turn to approach the three mics on center stage. The plays have been translated into Pashto, the language of the tribal region. Live performance is a rarity here because of the sensitive religious climate, and so the audience is transfixed. The hour-and-a-half-long broadcast feeds directly to a local radio station, where it goes out to stations throughout the region. Sarah Wazir's play ends with the young girl winning over her father and going to school. The audience is clearly moved, leaping to its feet with applause. Sarah is confident that the production will make a difference, especially among younger listeners.
It's very hard to change someone's minds, like the age of 60 and 70. The time is changing now slowly. If this drama is listened by the age of 25 and 20, they will say, okay, they are right, we have to do this. They can bring a change.
For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Peshawar, Pakistan.
Yeah, believe it or not, what kept me alive is my dreams.
I'm a dreamer, but I ain't the only one got problems, but we love to have fun, this is our world.
That's Kanon, a singer from Somalia. We'll hear more from him later, but right now we go to Somaliland. It's a region the size of Pennsylvania that sits on Somalia's northern border. 17 years ago, it broke away from Somalia and declared itself a free and independent country. The trouble is, no one else agrees. Not a single country has ever recognized Somaliland. So from the world's perspective, it officially remains a province of Somalia. But unlike its war-torn, lawless neighbor, Somaliland is peaceful and stable. Richard Locke launches our series on Somaliland from the capital, Hargeisa.
The dusty streets of Hargeisa are lined with outdoor cafes. Men congregate here in the early morning to watch as the city comes to life. In front of them, currency vendors push wheelbarrows piled high with grubby banknotes. Young boys ride their donkey carts to the river to collect water. Ice cream trucks start their rounds. The morning glass of sweet, milky tea is a time to talk politics.
I think as you see, Hargeisa is very peaceful.
Newspaper editor Abdullahi Omar gestures in front of him. In Hargeisa, the police are only armed with fluorescent batons to direct the traffic.
Everybody is going to his work peacefully. There is no guns. You can walk free, even at the midnight. And I think it's the most peaceful region in East Africa.
But it hasn't always been that way. In 1960, Somaliland and Somalia gained independence from Britain and Italy, their respective colonial powers. Within days, the two liberated countries entered into a union, with Mogadishu as their capital. But Somaliland quickly became the poor relative, the forgotten partner. In the 1980s, the union reached a breaking point. Somaliland launched a war of independence against Somalia that it won in 1991. But that wasn't the end of Somaliland's struggle. This amateur film shows the city of Hargeisa razed to the ground. Edna Aden, one of Somaliland's best-known and best-loved figures, shot the footage. She was a senior United Nations official and is the former wife of Somaliland's second president. To this day, Aden remains haunted by what she filmed in Hargeisa.
We're seeing the city that was absolutely empty of people because it was still landmined. There were a lot of booby traps. And people hadn't returned to it. They were still in refugee camps in Ethiopia and elsewhere. The suburbs of the city also had mass graves, many of them with the remains of children.
Somaliland needed rebuilding in every way. There were few houses left standing. There were no hospitals, no schools. So Somalilanders turned to the one thing war couldn't destroy, their clan-based society. Clan elders from across Somaliland sat down under acacia trees and held conferences in the ruins of schools. Armed with nothing more than their influence, they disarmed their militias and began to build a sovereign state. Despite these strides, Somalilanders say that the world has turned its back on them by refusing to recognize their country.
Everything that you see today has been put together by Somalilanders themselves. We had no support from the World Bank. We've had no loans, no grants. Somalilanders were just left to their own devices.
And that's what angers people in the cafes here. Why, they ask, does the international community pour millions of dollars into Somalia, one of the world's most hopeless places, when their own stable, peaceful government receives no direct assistance? The answer lies in international politics. The West says the African Union should be the first to recognize Somaliland. But Somalilanders suspect the AU won't do that for fear this would set a dangerous precedent, encouraging other regions seeking independence to follow suit. Somaliland's president, Dahir Riali Kahin, is a charming, affable man. But the world's stance on his country frustrates him.
You know, we are in a bad situation because the international community, they have taken the wrong decision. Legally, we have fulfilled all conditions of statehood. Are a functioning state, we are going forward. And we become a people who are patient and try to survive under these conditions.
This year, the government's entire budget is a modest $50 million. That's what Oprah Winfrey reportedly once spent on a house in California. But across the capital, multi-story buildings are springing up. Car dealers compete to offer the lowest prices on imported SUVs, and telecommunication companies advertise broadband internet. So how is all this possible?
The technology that we brought here was not here before. And that itself, you know, it's a leapfrog.
Abdul Waberi fled Somaliland during the war. For the last 20 years, Waberi has lived in the US and Canada, but now he's back and has set up a successful internet company in Hargeisa. He admits longing for his country played only a small part in his return.
It was first and foremost is business. I mean, you know, business is business.
But the Somaliland diaspora isn't just investing its money in business ventures. It's investing in the country's people and its future. Expats keep the country afloat by sending home up to $300 million each year in remittances. Like many developing countries, Somaliland does have its share of problems. A UN official in Hargeisa spoke of flagrant corruption within the government. And the only radio station on the air is run by the government. Independent radio stations are banned, although there are several privately owned newspapers. But compared to the mayhem in Somalia, Somaliland still stacks up well. So Edna Aden, the former First Lady, says the international community's position towards her nation is a slap in the face.
Failing to recognise Somaliland is failure to recognize democracy itself. The achievements of Somaliland could have been good examples for other African countries.
Next year, Somalilanders will vote in their third elections in 18 years. That in itself is a remarkable feat in this region. Somalia has not held elections since the 1960s. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Hargeisa, Somaliland.
As we just heard, Somalia is a failed state. It's one of the most violent places in the world. And it's the country that rap singer Kanan left behind as a teenager. Kanan ended up in Toronto and made his mark on the music scene there. His latest album, Troubadour, will be out next month. Tendai Maposa is our guide to global music. He joins us now. How are you doing, Tendai?
I'm doing good, Peggy. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I want to start this interview off by, first, let's talk about Kanan's childhood. He was raised on some very rough streets in Mogadishu. What was life like for him growing up there?
I can only imagine it, but it was really difficult because he grew up during the civil war in Somalia. Death, gunshots, and violence was a backdrop all the time that he was growing up in a very rough neighborhood in Mogadishu. His dad left for the United States, where he started driving a cab in New York City. And his mother was trying to get the family to join the father, and she only managed to get out on the very last commercial flight out of Mogadishu in 1991.
How old was he then, do you know?
He was only 14.
14. How did he get turned on to rap music?
Besides the money that he sent home, his dad also used to send rap albums. Kanan learned to rap to the music of Nas and Eric B. and Rakim, some of the best rappers around then. But that's how he learned, and he didn't even speak any English then, so he learned phonetically.
That's so interesting, because he didn't speak English, and yet the rap music here is about violent streets in the U.S., and yet there's no comparison with what Kanan was dealing with in Mogadishu.
Well, I mean, compared to what is happening in Mogadishu and what was happening in Mogadishu then, the violence that the rappers in the United States talk about in the ghettos is kids' play.
And I think Kanan actually has a song about this, where he's not making fun of American rap, but he's talking about, hey, what you guys have here is nothing.
We're talking about a song called What's Hardcore, and here he paints a very graphic picture of what is happening or what was happening in Somalia when he was growing up. And if anybody, you know, people listen to the news, Somalia is still very much in the news. It's still one of the most dangerous places in the world. You can't go half a block without a roadblock. You don't pay at the roadblock, you get your throat shot. And each roadblock is set up by these gangsters, and different gangsters go by different standards. For example, the evening is a no-go unless you want to wear a bullet like a logo. In the day, you should never take the alleyway. The only thing that validates you is the AK. They chew on chat, it's sort of like coca leaves, and ain't no police. So what's hardcore? Really? Are you hardcore? So what's hardcore? Really? Are you hardcore? I'ma spit these verses cause I feel annoyed and I'm not gonna... Well, this really puts American rap in perspective, doesn't it? It surely does. It surely does.
And what's the response to him here in the United States and Canada?
Well, I can only talk about the response elsewhere in the world where I've been. And he was nominated in the Best Newcomer category and at the BBC Radio 3 Music of the World Awards in 2007. He was the most anticipated artist of the day. Unfortunately, he didn't show up because his wife had just given birth to their first child. So, but the good thing is he won that category.
Tendai, Kanan hasn't forgotten his African roots, even though he sounds very much like a Western rapper. I want to know how his childhood and his home influenced the way his music sounds today, if at all.
There's still a lot of very, very strong African influences there. And he also does collaborations with African rappers, with African musicians. There's a track called Soba on the first album, The Dusty Foot Philosopher. Like the beginning of it, you'd really mistake it for an African song.
Talk to you directly. I can't ignore, I can't escape, and ask 'cause you shackle me, you shackle me, you shatter my whole future in front of me. This energy is killing me. I gotta let it pour like blood sober. Nabki wa di ten na gala soba. Nabki wa ba ten na gala soba. Biki wa ba ten na gala soba.
You listen to the ululating. Listen to the chant, just the rhythm. It could be people singing down the road for me. The rhythm, you know, the percussion, it really sounds very, very African.
He's released a new album, or he's about to release a new album at the end of next month called Troubadour. And only a few songs from that album have been released so far. What do you think of them?
I think he's making progress. I think he's growing stronger. From what we have heard so far, it's promising to be, it will be a hit for him, you know.
I had a chance to listen to one of the songs called ABC, which again has very strong lyrics about life in Somalia. I'm from the most risky zone, no place is more shifty global. More pistols, Russian revolvers, we shoot and all that is normal. But it ain't just because we want to, we ain't got nowhere we can run to. Somebody please press the undo, they only teach us the things the guns do.
Pretty thought-provoking messages in that song. He's representing his reality. That's what he's doing. That's what people love about him. He's not somebody who's fronting. And
when you say fronting, you mean pretense, I take it?
Yeah, pretending, exaggerating. All these wannabe gangster rappers, you know?
Yeah, he's the real thing.
Yeah, he's the real deal.
Tendai, thanks, and we'll check in with you again sometime soon, I hope.
Thanks, Peggy. As always, it was nice to be here.
Tendai Maposa is our guide to global music. He spoke to us from Zimbabwe.
So, in the beginning, there was a hum from a poet whose pulse fell drum, drum, drum. He will perform praise and all to one day.
Ahead on the World Vision Report, we talk water. Sound boring? Stay with us. You'll be surprised. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. It's hot in Morocco, very hot. And what's worse, there's been a severe drought for more than two decades. The scorching climate has damaged crops and incomes. That's what drove one farmer named Mustafa off his land. He now lives in the city of Rabat, where he makes a living selling water. Sarah Kramer has this next installment of our Street Vendor series.
Morocco's sun is relentless. The bright glare forces your eyes to squint, and the heat makes the sidewalks broil. Tourists can get relief by buying bottles of water from corner stores, but locals have a cheaper option. His name is Mustafa. Mustafa advertises his one simple offering with a bell and the tinkling sound of his brass cups as they dangle off the hooks of his satchel. He's a grub, a water seller. He roams the city with a sack of water he fills at the public fountains dotting the Medina, a 400-year-old maze of narrow streets in the middle of modern Rabat. And if the sound of the bell doesn't catch your attention, his clothes will. Mustafa dresses in a bright red jacket and a wide-brimmed hat with colored tassels. This traditional outfit, worn by water sellers all over the country, signals a walking oasis.
People who want to drink appreciate this outfit. They love it because it has history. Without it, people won't come to me.
Mustafa likes his work, but he's not tied to it. Before becoming a grub, he was a farmer.
In the countryside, there isn't rain anymore to grow anything. There's no water. So now this is my work, giving water to people. It's an act of goodness, and people respond by being good to me.
Growing crops or selling water, he is doing it all to send his three young daughters to school.
If I find better work than this, I'll do it. If it helps the children to learn, I'll do it.
Today, Mustafa has chosen a bustling place to work, a bus stop. Every few minutes, people come up to him and say, shrub, which means drink, or they just mime the act of drinking. That signals him to pour a cup of cool water out of the furry sheepskin sack he carries on his shoulder. His customers this afternoon include a young woman in a headscarf waiting for the bus and an elderly man walking by. Both give him a half dirham coin, about 6 US cents, after they quench their thirst.
Merci. Merci.
Asu Magraman, who's a regular customer, explains why he goes to the grub instead of the corner store.
There are people who buy bottled water, but the water from the garab sack, there's something special in it. It's not the same as tap water or as bottled water. There's goodness in the water. That's because the garab puts a little sap from a tree in the forest into his sack, so the water smells and tastes good. There's a difference.
Mustafa leaves the price of his water up to the customer. At the end of a good day, it can add up to about $10. He makes more money when tourists want to snap photos of him. For that, he charges 10 dirhams, about $1.25. But Mustafa doesn't always demand a payment for his product. A small boy with dirty clothes comes up to him and points to his mouth. The boy has no money. He's been on the streets begging and he has come by for a drink of water. Mustafa doesn't hesitate. He pours a cup and gives it to the child without a word. For the World Vision Report, this is Sarah Kramer in Rabat, Morocco.
It's something most of us take for granted, clean, drinkable water. But millions of people, 1 in 6 to be precise, don't have access to clean water. When Sarah Bird found that out, she decided to do something about it. About a year ago, she founded a company in Pakistan called Safwater. It sells tiny chlorine tablets directly to the public, so people can purify their water themselves. We wondered what would drive a 27-year-old British woman to pick up and move to Pakistan and start a company there. The work certainly isn't glamorous or exciting, and it's far from home. We invited Sarah onto the show to tell us her story. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Peggy. Thanks for having me.
Well, why don't you tell us, how did you come up with the idea to sell chlorine tablets in Pakistan?
I'm an engineer and I've worked in water and sanitation in a bunch of places and got to know a lot about the technology and was always very excited about technology. But then at some point you realize that it's all well and good to create new technologies, but those technologies aren't getting out there. And so what really sort of caught my attention is not how can we make a better gadget to clean water better, but how can we get existing and great technologies? You know, we've known how to clean water in this country for over 100 years. How do we get that to the billions of people that need it? Because it's just not getting out there.
If we've known how to do this for 100 years, why has it been so difficult to get that to countries that don't have clean water?
There's just a sort of an accident of history there, which is the way that our water systems grew up in the US, the UK, where I'm from originally. That was governments, big, big social programs, putting in large amounts of infrastructure. And in developing countries, oftentimes the government doesn't have the revenue or the resources to sort of put those systems in place in the first place. And then a second aspect is that a lot of the communities we work in, Safwater works predominantly in urban areas, often in formal settlements where with mass urbanization, as people come from the rural areas into the urban areas to seek opportunities, they're settling in a completely informal way where the government isn't able to keep up with the town planning necessary to find homes for all those people. And so people end up living in a situation where there isn't a water pipe coming into their house, there isn't electricity, there isn't sewerage and so on. And so all these problems compound and make it even more difficult for the government to then, who would be the traditional person to put in this infrastructure, it makes it even more difficult for that to happen.
Describe for us the water that these people, where you're working in Pakistan, what is the water like? How bad is it?
There is literally, in some cases, sewage backed up into it. Unfortunately, in Karachi, a lot of the clean water pipes have been laid next to the sewage pipes. And as infrastructure degrades, those pipes crack and you know, one leaks into the other.
So you came up with this idea to sell chlorine tablets. Now, we've talked about infrastructure. I mean, this seems so simple. Instead of building a whole infrastructure and fixing the pipelines, you simply drop a chlorine tablet in a glass of water. Can it be that simple?
Yeah, it can. I mean, somebody somewhere in the world, when you turn on your tap, someone's dropped in their tablet of chlorine into your water for you. I mean, the chlorine is how we all treat our water, and people that have gone before us have spent a lot of time figuring out how we can revamp that system of mass chlorination into household chlorination. That has lots of applications. The military use it, you know, people in emergency relief use it when there's a disaster, and so there's a lot of history why these systems, why these newer sort of household level technologies have been created.
Can you give me an example of what a sales pitch might look like? So a woman from the community who works for you knocks on the door and tells them about these chlorine tablets. What would she say to the woman of the household who might be a little untrusting of this new product that she hasn't used before?
Well, firstly, she'll obviously set up the scenario that you know that you have dirty water and that, you know, we should be doing something about it and that it's important for our community. There's a lot of desire to do good by the community, so that's, and especially to do good by your kids. So we make sure we stress how important clean water is for your children. And so she'll stress that and she'll talk about it, and then she'll introduce the product. And the product is very cheap. It costs 30 rupees for a week.
What is 30 rupees?
It's about 40 cents.
Okay. Now, we do a lot of stories about nonprofit groups helping the poor in the developing world, and usually they get funding from Western donors and they give these things away. Why are you selling and charging people for these tablets instead of giving them the tablets and getting the funding somewhere else?
This is a thing I feel quite passionately about. There's a lot of NGOs doing a lot of amazing work in the world, and there's two things, I guess, that motivated me to start this as a for-profit. One is that there's been this sort of international aid industry for a long time, and there's been a lot of hard work and a lot of effort put out there, and yet we still have unfathomably huge global problems on global scales that we're not even close to making a dent in. The product that we sell, these chlorine tablets, they're out there. They're out there in the marketplace. They're out there being distributed by nonprofits at the moment, and they're hitting less than 1% of the global need.
Why is that?
In my opinion, a lot of NGOs just don't get to scale, and they don't have the profit motive, if you like, to scale and scale and scale and scale. And this brings me to the second thing, which is there's a constraint on funding. So every time they want to scale a program a little bit bigger or launch a new program, they have to go to donors. And so we are reliant on our customers. And as long as we're providing a valuable service to our customers, we're going to be able to not only sustain ourselves, but also grow. That's a pretty powerful thing if you think about the size of the problem we're trying to address.
Is it hard to convince these women to come to work for you? And how much money are they making?
It's not hard. There's significant unemployment and underemployment in the areas we work in, so any job opportunity is interesting to folks. What's hard for us is finding the right profile of people. What we're paying people is we offer them basically a performance-related salary. So the more customers they have, the more their salary is. And for the target earning for all of our ladies is 9,000 rupees a month. Now, we're talking about bringing on women that could be illiterate, could have a fairly low skills base, and the other options open to them are domestic work, peeling shrimp, various sort of forms of manual labor like that. And 9,000 rupees as a salary is more the kind of salary you see as a driver, as a secretary, as a skilled worker. And so we're really offering a strong economic opportunity for them. We also offer, per area we work in, each year our top sales representative is sort of up for a 100,000 rupee prize, which is what we call our President's Club, where they can really, you know, be rewarded very, very highly for strong performance. So we offer some pretty strong economic incentives. But what I would say is, when you were asking earlier about, is it hard to get these women? Actually, a lot of the women are actually much more motivated by the social cause. The money is important and necessary, but what they really care about is the opportunity to do something good for their community. And that's a huge differentiator between any other job that they could get in the community if they could get a job.
And I've noticed that all your salespeople are women. You call them sales ladies. Why not salesmen?
I'm trying to get more in the habit of not saying sales ladies. We do have one salesman. Predominantly, though, water is a woman's problem. And moreover, women are the people that are sitting at home all day taking care of the kids. And so they're the people that are available to engage in purchasing surf water. And it's just not culturally appropriate in Pakistan for a man to go knocking on the door of a house where there's just a woman in the house.
You've sold to about 100 families, and I'm curious as to what they're saying. How long have they been using the product, and how well is it working in their homes?
We have some customers who've been with us for 6 months now, who started buying it and just love it. And one great lady from an area of town called Kimari, we asked her why she's buying the product. We asked her exactly the question you're asking, and her answer was, I've been waiting for a product like this, but there was nothing out there for me to buy, and now there is. No one was serving her need, and now we're there, and she loves the product, and she's delighted to be able to use it.
Now, Sarah, you're 27 years old. You're an engineer.
I am.
And you just picked up and moved to Pakistan. What has this experience been like for you as a young woman?
Fabulous. Pakistan has an unfortunate reputation in the media. It just isn't like that when you're there. I've had the privilege to work in a number of other countries. Above anywhere I've been in the world, it is unbelievably hospitable and welcoming. What's nice for me as an English speaker is that most people in Pakistan at all levels speak some English, which makes it a lot easier for me to operate. Yeah, it's a fun place to be. We are trying now, as I said, as we try and bring on batches of Southwater sales representatives to scale up to have between 150 and 200 sales reps by this time next year, and around 20,000 customers by the end of 2009 is the big sort of goal that we're shooting for right now.
That's a big goal.
You know, what's crazy is if you'd asked me a year ago, the idea of just getting the first 10 customers was unbelievably scary. Now we're at 100 plus, and the idea of getting 20,000 is unbelievably scary.
Well, Sarah, we're going to be checking in with you and just keeping up with how that's going, and we wish you the very best.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the time, Peggy.
Sarah Bird founded the water purification company, Softwater. She spoke to us during one of her trips to the U.S. We end our show today with a visit to Havana, Cuba. Havana was once known for being one of the most exciting night spots in the world. There were cabarets, music, cigars, and rum. Writers like Ernest Hemingway and Graham Greene produced some of their best-known works there while hanging out in the city's bars. But for many, the real magic of Havana can be found in the simple pleasures of the city as the sun goes down. Amelia de Souza brings us this reporter's notebook as part of our series on life in Cuba.
A bicycle taxi weaves through early evening traffic on Paseo de Martí. The young man pedaling huffs a little as he pulls a passenger in the cart behind him. They pass crumbling Baroque facades and cramped alleyways clogged with hanging laundry, old cars, and children playing ball. BC taxis are a common way for Cubans to get around. They cost just pennies a ride. The bike coasts down El Prado, the long boulevard that leads to the sea, where families stroll with their children under a canopy of trees. At the end of the Prado is the Malecón. Some people call this the soul of Havana. It's the old seawall that sweeps along 5 miles of the north coast. Young lovers come here to watch the sunset and to escape the crush of the city. They lounge on the wall and linger in the darkness, pressed between city traffic and surf. The Malecón bends around a small outcropping known as the Monument to Students of Medicine. It's a favorite spot for fishermen who come here to pass the time and catch small scraps for dinner. 6-inch red snapper or sardines. One young man holds a line with his fingers, his hook in the inky water below. The other end is tied to a rock at his feet. He comes here with his father almost every day. Fishing entertains me, he says. I could stay out here all night. Across the channel from the monument to students is Fort Cabana. It protected the city from pirates in the 1700s. Families and foreign visitors by the thousands walk the cobblestone road to come here every evening for the cañonazo, the firing of the cannon. Soldiers with bayonets and powdered wigs march into the fort with torches, recreating a ceremony that has announced nightfall in Havana for hundreds of years. From a turret on the far wall, a young soldier in a three-pointed hat cups his hands around his mouth and sings that the sun has hidden itself away and the moon is out. Another soldier with a large drum hanging around his neck beats out a rhythm as the soldiers surround one of the great cannons on the wall of the fort. Across the channel lies the city of Havana, sparkling with thousands of bright points in the night. Fathers hoist small children onto their shoulders to get a better view. The officer gives the order to light the cannon, and a drum roll begins. The few thousand people huddle together and brace themselves as the torch is lifted higher into the air. And then... everyone jumps together, then cheers. It is officially night in the old city. And as the soldiers file out of the fort, the crowd slips away as well, heading back to the city and into the night.
Amelia de Souza is a reporter based in Haiti. She took some great photos of Havana. You can see them on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And that's where you can hear the rest of the series on Cuba. You can also read blogs from Amelia and other reporters. And you can download a podcast if you'd like to take us with you. This program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Cynthia Graber and Christina Darden are our producers. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. Our interactive editor is Larry Short. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.